welcome you, first of all. Thank you for answering our call to this series of talks that we start today with Father René. iFaith is something that has come up quite accidentally in the group Friends of Augustine that we meet every month here in this place. We tackle various subjects of faith, and now being the year of faith and celebrating the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, we thought that it would be a good idea to go deep into Vatican Council II doctrine that sadly enough we don't know much about it, and often we don't practice it, the doctrine that we have received through this great council, giving some fresh breath to the church in the 60s and during the past 50 years. In the program, you see a note there that says, I have noticed that people with faith all walk around with a limp. You must have seen me very often walking with a limp. Through football and the damage that I have done, I very often walk with a limp. And especially these past 2 years when I have done a knee replacement, I walk very often with a limp. But this sentence touched me of Dorothy Sell, that she said, all people of faith walk with a limp, in the sense that we are striving to keep our faith, to believe, to keep it strong. And we often falter, we often go down. This is not bad in itself, but we need to practice the faith. We need to know more, and that's the reason for these lectures that we are starting today. This is a movement, thank God, for the 50th anniversary of the Vatican Council. This is a movement that is going all around the Catholic Church, especially even in England. I have just received a tablet of this week that says organizers were doing something like we are doing here now, and they had planned to do a meeting at Heythrop College in Kensington, West London, but there were so many people, they had to move to a nearby Anglican church of St. Mary Abbot so that they can accommodate all the people who were interested. There were about 400 people attending this conference, this meeting, like ours, discussing especially why the Second Vatican Council is not yet applied in the church today, at least most of it. We know that we say Mass in Maltese, but we need to know too that the Vatican Council was more than that, than the vernacular saying of the Mass. So I leave it now to John, who is going to chair the meetings, the program. He will explain exactly what will happen. We are the church. The church is not the Pope or the bishops or the priests. You are the church, and we are all the church. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everybody. I think that this is an extraordinary occasion for us to understand more what's going on. I think what you need to bear in mind is that Vatican II was a major historical event. As Father Hilary said, we are the church. The church actually opened the door to everybody and make it very clear that baptism has all made us Christians. And whether we are religious or lay, we are all baptized in the same way, and we all belong to the church. And therefore, responsibility for the church belongs to all of us. But having said that, let me pass on to Father René so we can start. One important point. We have decided to have the proceedings in English because we know there are a number of English-speaking persons in the audience, and it would be difficult for them to follow otherwise. And we Maltese all understand and follow English. When it comes to questions and answers, please feel free to use any language you like, as long as it's one which we can understand. so that everybody can feel comfortable. I don't suppose I need to introduce Father René. Professor René Camilleri is one of our most prominent theologians. He teaches theology at university. He is one of the advisors of our current archbishop, and he is a regular contributor to our media. So having said that, let me pass on to Professor Camilleri.
On the back of the leaflets and program, there is a prayer that we are going to recite together at the start of the meeting. Lord, make us prophets of our times, pilgrims, not wayfarers. May each day begin with prayerful preparations, opening our hearts to a spirit of loving repentance. Make us aware that although individuals, we travel with others, and help us to keep vigil with you in the holy place within the heart. May each event and ending of the day be Eucharist, leaving behind something of ourselves in sacrifice, so that we can celebrate and exult with joy, determined to allow Christ be reflected in us more and more, thus heralding a new age of hope and joy and freedom.
So, good evening to all. I'm honored to open this series of meetings and talks. And this evening, I was invited to speak about the meaning of Vatican II for the Church. Of course, I had various options, and I opted not to give a systematic presentation on the content of Vatican Council II. Not because I am not interested in the content, we are interested very much in the content of Vatican Council II. But of course, I think that speaking this evening about the meaning of Vatican Council II for the Church, and particularly for the Church today, puts me more in, in search of understanding the Church in the process of in the processes of history and of time. And so I will refer, of course, to contents of the documents of Vatican Council II. And this is something which, of course, you will be revisiting in the coming talks. But mainly, I am going to concentrate on the meaning of the event in mid-20th century. And so the meaning of Vatican II for the Church, and I would say even for Christianity as a whole. Well, in the struggle to grasp our new reality, churches and church leaders in our time have become painfully aware that our inherited concepts, our language, and indeed our whole way of thinking are inadequate to describe what is going on both in and around us. In the face of this, even the most confident amongst us would have to admit, in our more honest moments, that the Church as we know it faces a very significant adaptive challenge. It was Einstein, if I'm not mistaken, who wrote that the frame of mind to resolve the world's problems cannot be the same frame of mind that created them. And so the viewpoint we have of the Church and we can have of the Church, which we really need today, depends on from which standpoint we are going to look at things and at reality. There are so many different versions and perceptions and views of Christianity and of the shape that it takes in a specific church. And so it is difficult today to speak simply of the Church. We have to acknowledge that there are many different churches. not only many different perceptions of churches, but there are many different churches. That is how it was in the first centuries of Christianity, when diversity, even pluralism, was acknowledged without any particular difficulty. But a time came when that diversity was looked upon with suspicion, as threatening. Unity became uniformity, and it had to be visible in the language spoken and in the rites celebrated. But Christianity was never meant to be monolithic. It was meant to celebrate, not fear, diversity. We have four Gospels, which give us four portraits of Jesus, at times very different one from the other. I think one major achievement of Vatican Council II, which today we are celebrating, was precisely to acknowledge that Catholicism, being global, necessarily needs to embrace diversity. Today we are not simply commemorating a past event, something that happened 50 years ago. We simply are on a building site, trying to understand where we've come from, where we stand, and where we are heading to. For many, Vatican II is being commemorated for the significance it had as a major ecclesial event that marked 20th century Christianity. For many others, it simply happened and was the cause of confusion in the minds and hearts of people. I consider it a work in progress. One of the buzzwords today is imagine. Imagine. Who knows how much it costs to make George Clooney say the word? Imagine made John Lennon dream of a different world way back in the early 70s. It will become our catchword now with Imagine 2018. We need to imagine. The God we believe in is imaginative, otherwise he would not have been creative. Vatican Council II, way back in the 60s, 50 years ago, restored in the church, amongst other things, the possibility of imagination. We had stopped imagining that things in the church could be different, without realizing that, you know, the worst opposite of belief is not unbelief, but that in belief there is nothing to explore further or to discover. The world at that time was at a turning point. It was the post-war period, the time of the Cold War. Times were even changing fast. But the church was stuck. It was stuck doctrine-wise and in its liturgy. It was fossilized as an institution. It was frozen as a frame of mind. This reminds me of William Stafford's poem, Ask Me, where he imagines times when the river is ice, and you look at it and wait, knowing that the current is there underneath, hidden but flowing, and there are comings and goings from miles away. When June the 23rd, on Sunday 25th, 1959, 25th January, announced his intention to convene the council, he must have imagined who knows what. When he opened the council in his inauguration speech, he said, well, it may take us till the end of October, or it may even take us till the end of December. People around him were shocked. He was meant to be a transient pope. He was 79 at the time. Yet the current had been there underneath, waiting to be listened to and heeded. Innovation is the lifeblood of any organization. Innovation stands for new processes, methods, or inventions. There are four essential ingredients to a definition of innovation. Innovation has to be something new. It has to be better than what already exists. It has to be economically viable, and it needs to have widespread appeal. If we put Vatican II in this definition, name it and you have it. That's it. Vatican II was for innovation. Vatican II was and had to be innovative. It called on us to do away with the old wineskins, not to lose the new wine. Unfortunately, we've been through times when the miracle at Cana was reversed, with the new wine turned into water again. The Second Vatican Council was a transforming moment in Catholicism that enhanced diversity and change, engaged Catholics with the problems of the 20th century, and created a world church. Prior to the council, the church did not apparently have much of relevance to say to the world outside. Not much capacity for internal reform. The attitude towards change of many of those who ran the Roman Curia was an almost neurotic denial of all that was new. I'm quoting Ratzinger. Like any bureaucracy, the Curia relied on controlling, and the council could only be acceptable if it spelled out the central doctrines of the church and repudiated the modern versions of old heresies. The worry at the time of the council, at the time when John the 23rd announced the intention to convene a council, the major worries of the church were communism and Protestantism. When Pope John the 23rd announced the council, his sermon was a reflection on the so-called Church of Silence, codename for the persecuted church in communist countries. It was in that same mass that he announced the intention to convene Vatican Council II. Yet the official Vatican paper Osservatore Romano the day after put as headlines what the Pope said on communism. The announcement of the council was relegated to the center pages. Very symptomatic indeed. Well, the Roman Catholic Church is an institution deeply embedded in human culture. No one, and we have to be realistic here, because after all, Christianity is also a culture. No one can expect such an institution as the church, with such a long and glorious, if you want, history, to change overnight into something entirely different. Newman, a man of wisdom and balanced attitude, who had studied in detail the Arian crisis of the 4th century, in a letter dated 7th August 1870, had written that, I quote, "It is rare for a council not to be followed by great confusion," close quote. There was pain and confusion in the aftermath of Vatican II, because suddenly a culture was sort of disintegrating. Both on the inside and the outside of the church, Vatican II was indeed a culture shock. We have first to look at the church in cultural terms to understand the impact of the council. American sociologist Peter Berger in 1977 speaks of Roman Catholics, I quote, "once sitting pretty on the rock of Peter, but now rushing to find some plausible lifeboats with the rest of us," close quote. The idea of a council was dreaded back in the 40s and 50s. It was for some time in the air, yes. But the idea was not of convening Vatican Council II, a new council. The idea which was in the air was mainly of resuming Vatican Council I, which in July 1870 had come to an abrupt end and remained unfinished. Those who now were for renewal and were actually speaking of the need of reform were marginalized at the time. In 1950, Yves Congar, one of the major architects of the vision of the Church of Vatican Council II, a Dominican, French Dominican, in 1950, he wrote a seminal work on church reform, True and False Reform of the Church, the title of the book. It's a classic of 20th century theology. Yet in 1952, the Holy Office forbade the translation and reprinting of the book. And unfortunately, it was only last year, 2011, that it came out for the first time in English. Same with Henri de Lubac, who in 1953, while he was banned from writing and teaching, wrote his Meditation sur l'Église, translated in English as The Splendor of the Church. Both Congar and de Lubac ended up then as experts at the Second Vatican Council. And both of them died as cardinals. Yet, for fairness' sake, we have to mention also that already with Pope Pius XII, attempts towards some form of renewal were underway. Milestones in his pontificate, of course, are the two major encyclicals which he published in 1943, one on the Church as mystical body of Christ, and the other on scripture. Also in 1947, Pius XII wrote a letter on the reform of the liturgy, and in 1951, he reformed the liturgy of Holy Week, including the Easter Vigil as we know it, and as we celebrate it today. But, you know, in spite of these currents of renewal and reform, in spite of all this, well, a major cultural blow came in 1950 with his encyclical letter Humani Generis, which condemned false opinions undermining Catholic doctrine and attacked the so-called new theology and modernism. It was sort of, you know, a halting of the slide, Humani Generis in 1950. But, as they say, tardare si scappare no. It had to happen. Things were changing. If this insight pressure coming from, you know, heroes of Vatican Council II, I mentioned only two, Congar and de Lubac. We can mention a long list of them, including Karl Rahner. Well, if this inside pressure was not powerful enough to bring change, the weight of a fast-changing outside world was making itself felt. Even the outside world, demonized as it can be, is inhabited by the spirit. And events that mark or change history's course can be ways of speaking on the part of God. Catholics had securities and clear boundaries that gave them identity, but which were collapsing at the time. Old ways had to change. The wineskins had become too old to hold the new wine. The tension was increasing between those still in counter-reformation mode and those yearning for novelty. The post-Tridentine period had been a very slow and gradual resolution of issues raised by Martin Luther way back in the 16th century. But change was still shunned, and to speak of reform was still heretic in mid-20th century. The French Revolution had left its mark on society and on humanity. While the three great minds, Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, were giving shape to new thought, being radically critical of religion, the Church's response was still defensive and apologetic in outlook and in substance. The Syllabus of Errors in 1864, written by Pope Pius IX, it's still claimed, amongst other things, that it is sheer madness to speak of religious liberty or freedom of conscience. 1864. Pius IX, the author of the Syllabus of Errors, who was known as Il Papa Re, was the Pope who convened Vatican Council I, which, you know, ended up with the definition of the Pope's infallibility as a dogma. In spite of all this, and contemporary to this, there were also heavyweights of renewal and reform. I would mention at this point Rosmini in Italy, Newman in Great Britain, and Mahler in Germany. Rosmini in 1832 had already written his The Five Wounds of the Church. It was Vatican II, more than 130 years later, to confirm to us how that book was truly prophetic. For Rosmini, imagining the church crucified, that is why he calls his book The Five Wounds of the Church. For him, these five wounds were, let me, you know, mention them. First, the separation between people and clergy in the liturgy, 130 years before Vatican II. Second, the lacking education of the clergy. Third, the lack of unity among bishops. Fourth, the nomination of bishops. And fifth, the earthly possessions of the church and the church's political intrigues. Even Newman, at the same time, in mid-19th century, he was practically already charting the way forward for Vatican Council II, particularly with his essay on the development of Christian doctrine and his essay on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine, which he wrote in 1859. Pope Paul VI, bringing to a close Vatican Council II in December 1965, and rightly so, he said, well, the council which we are bringing to a close, we can rightly so call it Newman's Council, because Vatican Council II, on certain fundamental issues, even of doctrine and of framework, went back to Newman and refers to Newman very often. Even Mahler in Germany, on the same wavelength as Newman, already in the 1830s, was dreaming of an ecumenical Christianity. Catholicism has an incomparable intellectual, cultural, mystical, and spiritual heritage. Why then does it appear so stagnant, so lacking in self-confidence, enthusiasm, and purpose? What can be done to mobilize the religious potential of the tradition of Catholicism? There were many aspects of Catholicism that were stagnant in the decades before Vatican II. Just to mention one instance, I'm mentioning Cardinal Suhart, who was the Archbishop of Paris. In 1947, soon after World War II, he wrote a pastoral letter which was entitled The Rise and Fall of the Church. It was translated into Italian as L'Agonia della Chiesa, where he urges the church to mobilize itself, to give back Europe its soul. Otherwise, he writes, the church is in agony, is dying. There are times when leadership, in the face of the enormity of what must be done, becomes frightened, paralyzed, even retreatist. That was what was happening on the eve of the council, and what continued, unfortunately, to happen even after the council. I hold that, and I believe that all those present here, in some way or other, we are all committed, not necessarily and explicitly as Christians, but committed at least, you know, towards authenticity or the search for truth. That is a common ground between all of us. But I think that, and that is why I'm mentioning this, I think that for all of us, it is at some times more than others, it is painful to see people, friends, relatives, family members walk away from the church as it fails to speak passionately and compassionately to them. I think we all feel this pain. We tend to fear the risk of prophetic witness, and fear creates an atmosphere that is never conducive to boldness and to the boldness of the apostolic initiative and witness. The council was convened by John the 23rd because he felt that the church, at least since the French Revolution, had become gravely deficient in its willingness to move out and evangelize the world. The church before the council, we can easily speak of the church before the council as a very introvert church, as a very inward-looking church. But at the same time, there were radical shifts in thinking. Many may still have the feeling today that faith is stagnant, that religion is dying away, that people are largely secularized and becoming irreligious. Vatican Council II was meant to counter all this. It was meant to rejuvenate the church, to tell the world that faith is dynamic, that religion is still alive, that we still need God in life, and that we still need to explore new ways of searching and finding God. Vatican II was meant to tell us, against all odds, that diversity needs to be celebrated, not feared, that pluralism is challenging, not threatening, that there is still so much to explore and discover in the deepening of what we believe, and in grasping the meaning of life. It came to tell us that truth is symphonic. Vatican II was meant to take us back to the sources of the Christian faith, to make us go beyond the second millennium of the history of Christianity, which, with all its richness and movement, yet had made our faith and the church alike to enter into ruts rather than embark on adventure. Vatican II was meant to put adventure back into the venture of the church. It was a Pentecost. It was a springtime. In his book, The Theology of History According to Saint Bonaventure, Joseph Ratzinger, today Pope Benedict, exposes his basic approach to the situation of faith in the modern world. Of course, I believe myself that Vatican Council II, mainly, with all that we can say when we enter its content and the content of its documents, but basically I believe that Vatican Council II focuses on the situation of faith in the modern world. Now, when Ratzinger, in his The Theology of History According to Bonaventure, he writes, quoting Bonaventure, that only faith divides the light from the darkness. Only faith. This was the approach which located Ratzinger in Vatican Council II on the side of the great advocates of return to the sources in the council. Because even in Vatican Council II, of course, and this is something which we can realistically all of us imagine and acknowledge, that Vatican Council II was also a space of discussion, a space of debate. And so in Vatican Council II, there were even different schools of theologies and different currents. After the council, particularly when we speak of the situation of faith in the modern world, in the post-council, post-conciliar era, mainly, I can even sound simplistic, but I believe this is a very major point in the post-conciliar era. Well, two major theologians after the council undoubtedly were Karl Rahner and Hans Urs von Balthasar. And though they were both of them great theologians and great heroes of the post-conciliar church, yet they differed, you know, substantially in their vision. Because, you know, to put it simply, for example, the vision of Hans Urs von Balthasar, the Swiss theologian, his vision of the church in the world was that the church possesses the truth, and her mission is to bring the truth to the world. On the other hand, Karl Rahner, the German theologian, and whom I think we can say it because it is acknowledged by many, who practically was a mastermind in Vatican Council II, Hans Urs von Balthasar, in spite of the fact that he was one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century, but Hans Urs von Balthasar was absent from the council. Karl Rahner was present in the council. Now, Karl Rahner's view and vision of the church in the world, very different from Balthasar's, was not that the church possesses the truth and her mission is to bring the truth to the world. But his vision was that the truth lies out there in the world, and the church's mission is to discern where that truth is. Because the church's mission at the end of the day is to discern God's footprints in history. Because God did not create the world, the church. God created the world. God did not create Christians. He created man and woman in his image and likeness. So in Vatican Council II, there were already these two diverging visions of the church and of the mission of the church. Now, these orientations, of course, surfaced in the council, and practically, mainly, it was on the major text, one of the major documents, if not the major, of Vatican Council II, which is entitled Gaudium et Spes, which is the constitution on the church in the modern world. By many, it is considered as the major document. It was not in the agenda of the council, because, you know, even Vatican Council II had its agenda prepared by various commissions, which John XXIII, on the announcement of the council, himself had set up. And those commissions were to prepare different documents on different issues to be presented and discussed in the council. Now, there was no such document on the church in the modern world on this agenda. Because what was previewed was mainly a document on the church which speaks of the church ad intra, ad extra, the church in itself and the church on its outside, in its relation with the world. But along the way, during the debates of the council, this idea of a new document, much needed, on specifically on the church in the modern world, cropped up. And it came to be, at the end of the day, the major document of Vatican Council II. Now, this text was largely inspired by the French Dominican Marie-Dominique Chanou, and it followed an incarnational approach, looking in contemporary social and cultural movements for signs of an inspiration for the spiritual to which the church could address her message about Christ. It was practically and simply the method of reading the signs of the times. You know, what I said about Rahner's vision, reading the signs of the times, which practically means discerning God's footprints in the world, in society, in culture, even in what normally we consider a secularized culture. But this was the method chosen and underlying this major document of the council, which is Gaudium et Spes. It does not think of the church as being on its cathedra, simply to teach and to preach, but it speaks of the church as being, you know, in the process of history, part of this process, part of this history of humanity, side by side with humanity. That is what the first words of the document mean, Gaudium et Spes. The document opens by saying that the joy, Gaudium, and the hope, Spes, the joy and the hope of people today are the joy and the hope even of those who are disciples of Christ. Now, in this method of reading the signs of the times, Vatican Council II was seeking mainly to respond, first of all, with a dialogue respectful of the other. This was practically an extension of the basic Thomist understanding of the relation between church and world, nature and grace. After Vatican Council II, some blamed the decline of religion in Western countries on the Council's apparent affair with modernity, which prior to the Council had been roundly condemned. There were those who eventually moved into schism, you know, as a reaction precisely in line with this understanding of the Council. Those who ended up into schism, led by Archbishop Lefebvre. Others saw the collapse as inevitable, given the profound secularizing currents in Western culture. Yet others attribute this decline to a failure to implement the Council's teachings and the rearguard action of centralizing conservatives. This gives us just a sample of positions taken on the matter. But it is ample evidence that the interpretation of the Second Vatican Council, 50 years later, is still deeply contested. There have been mainly two contrary interpretations of the Council. On the one hand, there is, and these are practically today, they are two schools of thought. On the one hand, there is that school of thought which interprets Vatican Council II, understands Vatican Council II in terms of discontinuity and rupture. That, you know, Vatican Council II has been a rupture in the history of the Church in mid-20th century. This school of thought asserts that the texts of the Council, as such, do not yet express the true spirit of the Council. For them, the Council was simply a takeoff. On the other hand, there is the other school, the interpretation of reform, of renewal and continuity. And so these two schools of thought, one understanding Vatican II in terms of discontinuity, the other emphasizing continuity with the tradition of Christianity. Well, these are disputes of a hermeneutical nature. They are important, of course, but they risk also becoming controversies among experts. Basically, what we are concerned with is with the outcome of all this. The event of the Council was basically motivated by the desire to renew the inner life of the Church and to adapt to its discipline to the new demands of culture and of modern society. But to get to the root, we need to grasp the inner countenance of the Church that the Council sought to recognize and to represent to the world in its effort to update. What I believe is at the center of the Council's vision is, strictly speaking, not the Church, but the world. Vatican Council II, in all its 16 documents, is doing an effort mainly to understand the world, to understand people. The Church is only perceived as ordered towards the world and towards people. The perception of the Church as a reflection of the light of Christ unites Vatican Council to unites the Council to the Fathers of the Church. It is also symptomatic that, you know, another major document on the Church, which is entitled Lumen Gentium. Lumen Gentium means light of the nations. Now, the document on the Church in itself, so to say, which is entitled Lumen Gentium, the light of the nations, you know, well, it opened with the sentence that the Church, being the light of the nations, it was Pope Paul VI personally in the final session of the Council when this document was about to be approved and promulgated, that he inserted a correction personally, telling the fathers of the Council, it is not the Church which is the light of the nations. It is Christ who is the light of the nations. And so the first sentence, the introducing sentence of that document, was changed to read that Christ, the light of the nations. You know, it is a change of perspective. Because if we go back to the fathers of the Church, as Vatican Council II did, we will have surely a more fresh perception, understanding, and vision of the Church. There is no doubt that for many people at the time, Vatican II was a positively breathtaking spiritual event. 50 years later, for many, the conciliar texts may still be completely alien. There was a phase in the reception of the Council, a first phase, which may be considered as one having been one of exuberance, you know, seeing the Council as a liberating event. Then this phase was replaced by another phase of disappointment. Discussions on the interpretation of the texts of the Council, to which I have referred already, in spite of these discussions, but yet we still struggle with the implementation, which seems so difficult. The Council's vision was one of radical change. It was not meant to bring about cosmetic adaptations. Basically, the Council's vision was geared to prepare the Church spiritually to face the new challenges of the 21st century. It was not about the adaptation of the institution. It was about the rediscovery of the spirit of Christianity. By the end of the fourth and final session of the Council had promulgated in all 16 documents, 4 constitutions, 9 decrees, and 3 declarations. Appropriating the Council's teaching has proved to be a daunting task for several reasons in these last 50 years. First of all, the massive volume of conciliar documents, not at all easy to digest and to synthesize. Then something which distinguishes Vatican II from other councils, particularly from Vatican I in the 19th century and from the Council of Trent in the 16th century. Vatican II is radically different from these two councils, precisely because in Vatican Council II, there is no common theological or philosophical foundation to the documents. There have been significant compromises to achieve full consensus in the Council. And so there is no one school of thought underlying all that the Council has said. Maybe we are now in a third phase after the Council, a phase which can be decisive as to what future awaits us. The people who were there are no longer here. The world has also changed considerably since then, even where religion and religions are concerned. Many forces helped cause the disintegration of the traditional Catholic culture. But Vatican II was undoubtedly the most significant long-term factor in this disintegration. For centuries, the church had become an inward-looking culture. But the council's call to refound the church means not an escape from the world, but the development of creative and inventive pastoral action to relate the gospel to the issues of today. It was highly significant, coming from Pope Paul VI in the Synod of Bishops in 1974 on evangelization, when he said that the modern heresy is precisely the separation of the gospel from culture. This requires, of course, when we try to be creative and inventive, when we are still struggling to relate the gospel to the issues of the day, well, this requires of all of us a high tolerance of ambiguity as we still grapple with the pastoral implications of these issues. Many in the church find the ambiguity and patience too much to take, and they yearn for simplistic answers and the return to the order of pre-Vatican II. Vatican II was instead a springboard for a revitalized mission to the world that empowers mainly faith seekers to grow in wisdom and grace, enabling the church to strengthen the faith of the people at a time of great change, particularly in how they think and live. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Camilleri. I think Father René has been very inspiring in his presentation. And I'm sure there could be a number of questions. Now is the opportunity for you to put your questions or make your comments. Yes, sir.
Hello. First of all, thank you, Father René, for a fascinating and very informative talk. You squeezed in the Vatican Council in 45 minutes, which is no easy task. However, I noticed that during your speech, there was an underlying message or concept, which was fear. Stagnation and reactionism sometimes is born out of fear. In fact, very often it's born out of fear. This was on the part of the church. But I also think that a great threat to faith amongst the faithful today is also born out of fear. Fear that there is no satisfactory interlocutor between them and the God they are supposed to believe in. You know, our everyday life is full of fear. We fear of disease, fear of losing our jobs, fear. There are so many fears around, and people want consolation, they want understanding, they want compassion, and they want an interlocutor, a satisfactory interlocutor, that bridges this fear with the God that should provide happiness and joy. In fact, one of the biggest threats I see to the church today is there's a very little joy. I look around. I mean, you said that people of the faith go around with a limp. I also think that people of the faith go around with long faces very often. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I find this very, very illuminating. I'll just say very briefly, when the synod was passed around in Malta, when the questionnaire was passed around to all the church, to all the people, I didn't answer the questions. I wrote a little thing of what I thought. In a nutshell, I concluded that the church in Malta, because we live in Malta, had become irrelevant to the life at our time. Now, hearing you, I see that I knew nothing about Vatican Council, that the people who prepared the document and everything were very, very forward-looking. In fact, they anticipated what was likely to happen. But unfortunately, I can say about the church in Malta, it didn't adapt. Thank you.
In your talk, you mentioned five wounds you mentioned someone who said that the church has five wounds, and that was in the 19th century. I think that presently these five wounds are still there. And I think that tradition shouldn't be put forward to the message of God, the gospel, and the Bible. The Bible should be more directly in the church, ahead of the traditions. Otherwise, we are going near to the end.
Thank you for a very illuminating talk, Father René. Much appreciated. Obviously, as an architect, I was very interested in Vatican II as to the changes in terms of the propositions as how a church actually functions in today's society. And I think the major change which was indicated was that the people, the congregation, were no longer spectators, but they became participants. Obviously, the use of the vernacular, the change of the direction of the priest facing the church, and many other things, the removal of the pulpit. So the idea was that people were no longer spoken at, but that the priest spoke with the people. Unfortunately, I feel that while that was something which was very clearly indicated in Vatican II, even to this day, 50 years later, in Malta, I still feel the effect that the participants are not really taking part in the things, but they're still listeners, and they're still being spoken down to. And that is something which I regret, still worries me, and I would like your comments on that. Mm. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think, as you say, Ray, well, mainly, I think that when we try to understand deeply the Council's vision, and of course that's why I said that it is still work in progress, and you know, things are still, some say, probably to justify, but some say that, you know, what are at the end of the day 50 years in the context of Christianity, of the church, which has a 2,000 year history. But anyway, 50 years are quite a lot today, particularly. Well, I think that we are still on various aspects very stagnant and very tired. Because I think that we still need to discover, and this is basic for me, for the Council's vision of church today, we still need to discover that at the end of the day, the church's mission is not, now don't get me wrong, is not to preach and teach. But the church's mission, like Christ's was, is first of all to empathize, to be with the people where they are. The church's mission is to be, if you want, a facilitator. Because at the end of the day, what does the church exist for? Well, the church exists at least to help people to be in search of God, to be in search of the divine, and to find God. And that is the problem with Professor England's question, you know, on the liturgy. Unfortunately, you know, the liturgy, I mentioned Karl Rahner earlier. Well, Karl Rahner, in one of his essays on Vatican Council II, of course, Karl Rahner died in 1984, so it was one of his essays which he had written in the 70s on Vatican Council II. And quite, I would say, presumptuously, you know, because the document on the liturgy, Sacrosanctum Concilium, its title, was one of the first documents which was presented in the Council and promulgated in the Council. And it was very much forward-looking. It still is one of the deepest, one of the most profound documents of Vatican Council II. Of course, the reason behind that was that it was not prepared by a commission in Rome, but it was prepared by the Benedictines in France. Its draft, at least. In fact, Karl Rahner, in his essay on Vatican Council II, he says, well, I am positively sure that 75% of the Council Fathers who voted in favor of the document did not know what they were doing. Because it was far-reaching. And, you know, that is our problem. Unfortunately, you know, even to our situation, I consider it literally, it is very painful, no, for me. And what I'm saying, without offense, no, but if you go and check, for example, in the Curia's directory, you find that the president of the liturgical commission in the Church of Malta has been president of liturgical commission since 1965. You know, it says it all. And so I'm not going to add anything, you know. Besides that, we are still, and I've presented 2 and 3 questions, you know, without having any, of course, convincing answer in the Presbyterial Council on this, we are still, you know, with the Roman Missal, which was translated from Latin to Latinized Maltese, with the consequence that we still have, you know, prayers which are much more reminiscent of pagan culture, you know, offering sacrifices to this god, you know, to calm him down, you know, not to send punishments. And so, you know, that's the situation of the liturgy. So we are still very far from speaking of the liturgy in terms of sacred spaces, if you want, you know, where we can, you know, let people have a foretaste. Of course, that brings me to your remark. You know, unfortunately, yes. Now I'm a priest, and I've been priest now 33 years. And so it's painful for me even to speak out on certain aspects of the church. But I think that, you know, we need also to be realistic. You know, I continue to struggle in this church, you know, to as long as I have the strength to do it and the power to do it. But I think that, you know, we need to let go of so many other things. It's not always the fault of the church, let's be fair. Because, for example, culturally speaking, this is a country, and this is something which I've always, you know, said and repeated over and over again. Well, this is a very ambiguous country, you know. It's a country which you can easily define as, you know, ancient, modern, and postmodern at the same time, you know. Because we still, I spoke about new wine and old wineskins, but, you know, many of us want the new wine, but at the same time, we don't want to let go of the old wineskins, you know. It suffices to see, you know, the again, I mentioned the liturgy, for example, when during the summer months with the village festas, you know, in our parishes, in the majority of our parishes, well, all liturgical rules and all, you know, deep meanings of what the liturgy should be are suspended, you know, in that week. So we still are regardless of the perception. But, you know, we need to take more into consideration the perception which people have of the church. Many a time we have still this, you know, tendency to pontificate on people and to say that people, you know, are not right because they have wrong perceptions of the church. Well, people, their perceptions of the church, you know, they bring them from somewhere and from something. So we need to do something about it. You know, someone lately said, well, you know, if Rene Camilleri had said it, but anyway, it was the bishop-elect who said it, that PR in our church is a disaster. He said it, and it's true. We have no idea of PR. So, and that brings me to, you know, you mentioned the issue of traditions. Of course, one of the major achievements of Vatican Council II was the rediscovery of the scriptures, of the Word of God. In fact, one of the major documents of Vatican Council II, it is a constitution, it is precisely on God's revelation, Dei Verbum. And it was so important that it was the first document that was presented for discussion, and it was the last document after 3 years, 3 months, that was approved and promulgated. Because it, you know, practically, there is there a summary of all the basic issues of Christian life. How we relate with God, how we relate with Scripture. You know, how can we understand that God's revelation is not something, you know, which happened in the past? Because normally, even in our catechisms, in our theologies, in our doctrines, we always spoke in terms of God's revelation as being something that happened in the past. God spoke to Abraham, to Moses, to Peter, to Paul, you know. And then, you know, sort of he opted for an early retirement scheme, you know. But God's revelation is ongoing. The church's mission is to discern where God is, not whether God exists. You know, that's something of the past. We are no longer concerned mainly with atheism. But we are concerned mainly today with not who God is. Because, you know, who God is, theology, particularly scholastic theology, you know, Middle Ages, down to the 20th century. You know, gave us definitions of God which are not only not understandable, but I'm sure that God would, you know, create jokes over them. But anyway, the question is not who God is, but where God is. And that is the mission of the church and of the Christian. Now, of course, here it's a question of not traditions, but it's a question of the tradition of the church, this living tradition of the church. The last point I want to make on this is, because it's very significant, no? In this document, Dei Verbum, which I repeat, is a document which is concerned with basic issues of Christian life. Well, what is the most basic issue of Christian life? You know, it's not what the Pope is wearing this evening, but it is a question of how in my life, whether I'm a Christian, a Buddhist, a Muslim, whoever I am, how in my life I still can experience God. I still can, you know, experience the transcendent. I still can have the possibility of searching for God beyond me, you know. That is a basic issue. Now, in Vatican Council II, in Dei Verbum, on this document, practically there is a very significant passage which Vatican II quotes verbatim from Newman, 150 years earlier. Where practically it speaks about, you know, how does this tradition, this living tradition of the church continue? How is it perpetuated in the life of the church? Well, until Vatican II, we always used to say that this tradition of the church is perpetuated in the church through those who hold the office of teaching in the church, the Pope and the bishops. They teach. Because for us, faith was doctrine. And the only people competent in teaching doctrine were the Pope and the bishops. Now, Vatican Council II says, this is an ongoing process which is perpetuated in the church. Well, first, through the spiritual experience which faithful make of their faith. Then, through the theological reflection in the church, particularly mentioning the church fathers and theologians, and then, you know, not least, last but not least, those who hold office in the church. But not only, exclusively, by those who hold office in the church. Vatican Council II is acknowledging, you know, that we are church. You know, this is the what we started with this evening. We are the church. That we are all responsible, that we are all carriers, that we all have the authority to teach. The church is no longer seen as divided between the few who have the authority to teach and the majority who have only the duty to listen and to learn. Vatican Council II, in more than one document, gave us the message that the church, at the end of the day, is a church of learners. And it is something which we need to come to terms with, I think.
I think that your further reaction to those questions is very informative and educational. But I think we should draw a conclusion now, because we have agreed with Father Hilary that we don't spend longer than 7:30 to 9 in these sessions, so people don't get tired. I feel that the most influential statement that you have made is that Vatican Council II is work in progress. And essentially, therefore, it's not finished business. And essentially, what you have emphasized is that we need to realize that we are living in a dynamic world, a world which is continuously evolving. And therefore, the church needs to be part of that reality. The church needs to evolve also. But essentially, what you have stressed is that it is not the church that needs to lead, but it is the world that needs to lead. And God, having created the world, and God continuing in this creation, is signaling to the church what it needs to impart to its members. You have emphasized, and I think it is very fundamental, that we are the church. And therefore, there is no longer distinction between the teachers in the church and those who are taught, those who are leading and those who are led. We are one community. And basically, leadership is shared, and we are all learning. So essentially, we are living in a reality which is changing, a reality which is adaptive, a reality which is conditioned by the perception of that reality, and also a reality which is not exclusive to us who are Christians, but it is inclusive of all humanity. To a large degree, in my opinion, what the Vatican Council II has done is it has embraced the world. It has opened up to the world. It has liberalized our thinking. And it has challenged us in terms of becoming relevant to what reality is all about. Now, as you said, this has created a certain element of confusion. And some have argued that this has created a certain amount of discontinuity. Well, life is full of changes. But change is the essence of continuity. Unless there is change, there is death, and there can't be continuity. If we reach a stage of static being, then we don't evolve anymore, then we are dead. And we have to realize that this evolutionary process that the world is going through is influencing everything that is real, everything that is created. And creativity and creation itself is evolutionary by its very definition. I feel that what Vatican Council II has done is it has come down to earth. I feel that we have realized that we need to look at ourselves in a constant search for God and a constant state of learning. I very much liked your comment on one of the questions, that the church should not be a teaching church, but should be an empathizer and a facilitator. The church, that means all of us, need to help each other in order to reach our final objective, which is eternal happiness. And I feel that in the final analysis, even our whole concept of redemption is a continuous one. I like very much what Teilhard de Chardin had argued, that evolutionary is directional in terms of going forward and in terms of going upwards. In terms that there is a plan for creation, and that plan is God. And it is not only directional in terms
of having a sense of purpose, that it's leading somewhere, but it's also taking us always closer to God. But to do that, we have to be open. We have to understand the world that we're living in, and we have to understand creation, which is really the product of God's relationship with man. I thank you very much, Father René. You have been very inspiring, and I'm sure that you have done us a lot of good. Thank you very much.
We would like to give a little token of gratitude to Father René. I hope you don't have this book. So, but if you have, we'll change it. So, thank you once again. He hasn't got the book, so I'm happy.